Hello and welcome to Inside Selling. I'm Liston Witherell, partner at Sales DNA, where we help inside sales teams get more meetings and close more business without feeling salesy, manipulative, or gross. Today, I'm honored to have Dan Burrell on the show. Dan is the director of inside sales at Twilio, a really fast-growing company in San Francisco that's focused on communications as an API. Now, I do want to give you a quick note here that the audio quality is not where I would like it to be on this particular recording. I will do a better job in the future of making it really top-notch. But before we get to the interview, I do want to invite you to check out our articles about inside sales at blog.salesdna.co or our online training at courses.salesdna.co. If you use the code podcast, you can get 30% off any course you see on the site. And of course, if you'd like custom training or us to audit your B2B sales process, head over to our website and click contact. We'd love to start a conversation with you. And now, without further ado, I bring you my conversation with Dan Burrell, Director of Inside Sales at Twilio. All right, I'm here with Dan Burrell. Dan, how are you today, my friend?
I'm awesome, Liston. Thank you for having me.
So, Dan, it's actually my pleasure. And one thing that I want to be totally upfront about is you and I have a history together.
We do.
a good history. Yeah, a fun one. We worked together, what was it, like 6 years ago, 7 years ago?
Yes, I want to say seven.
Yeah,
we're getting old, my friend.
2010, 2011, which if anybody knew that about me, I'd probably never be hired in tech again, knowing that I have 7 years of work experience. And it's actually quite a bit more than that. But I'm excited to have you here, Dan. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
Cool. So one thing that you do as a director of inside sales and sort of something you did in a past life was a very strict, regimented, by the book, sort of by the numbers, cadence and account-based approach to inside sales. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, we were collaborating on outreach techniques, and I love that you brought up this topic. It's one that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, a lot of time executing, and frankly, a lot of time evolving over the years. You know, my introduction to this space was actually not long after you and I worked together. Mm-hmm. And so I've gone through the full learning cycle of how to prospect, how to add value, and how to get a stranger's attention. And so, you know, as with so many of us, I started literally with websites, combing for contact information, calling main lines, asking for names, trying to get routed through. And over the years, I realized that this is a process that can actually be very, very scientific. And so I built in some rigor. We learned from best practices, and there was a team that where we executed this most, where I'm most proud of it, is when I was working at Box, I was given a charter a couple years back to create a team that sourced 100% of its own pipeline. And that's a tough challenge for any team to operate and close deals without marketing support and to be fully self-fed. But it's a skill set that I think every sales rep should absolutely have. Mm-hmm. And so here's what we did. We had a massive amount of white space. And one of the toughest challenges I think that any rep or team faces when trying to tackle the white space is simply being overwhelmed by the number of places where you could spend your time.
Right.
So step one is you've got to narrow. And hopefully you can narrow against some dimensions that you already know about. You know what your customer profile either looks like today or what you want it to look like. And then you look for prospect accounts that have those attributes. Once you have those, start with a small list. That was always my number one advice. Do not try to tackle them all at once, because after 2 months of pretty intense chaotic work, you really just won't know what worked and what didn't. You might set meetings, you might have stumbled upon things that are absolute gold, but unless you were tracking really carefully the whole time, you actually won't know what to repeat and what to invest in again. So I encourage a very, very methodical approach to it. Start with a small list, and then from there, it's segmenting the individuals within that account, being very thoughtful about the departments and the titles of who might be interested in your message and exactly why they might be interested in their message. And when we say why, I mean, in this world of prospecting, we're talking about how do you add value to their world? How do you make them do their job better? How do you help them be more successful? How do you mitigate risk, whatever the case might be? And then it's a process, you know, for us, this was a process of designing a cadence to get in front of those people. I like a 6X or a 6-touch cadence over the span of a week or two, depending on how aggressive you want to be. And that's where I think you get to implement a little bit of your personal style and what makes you comfortable. For us, it was a equal combination of emails and calls. And then it was really rigorous tracking of those, really strict adherence to email one, follow-up call one, email two, follow-up call two. And the nice part about doing that is on a weekly or bi-weekly cadence, you're starting one set of five companies and you're ending a set of five companies. And so at the end of a week period or at the end of a 2-week period, you have clarity around what worked and what didn't. You know, this set of messages or this cadence felt right and delivered a meeting or two. And then you can iterate from that. So I think, you know, the last bit of advice that I remember giving to reps and still give to reps to this day is it's better to finish 2 things than to start 15.
Right.
Because to see the fruits of your labor, you have to complete the task.
Right.
And it's easy to get distracted by the shiny object or the new account or whatever the case may be in this world without finishing. So start your prospecting efforts. You can organize it in so many different kinds of ways, but then see it through to completion and make sure that you capture the learning from each one.
So you mentioned keeping the list small, and I really like that. And in this case, it sounds like it was 5 companies every 2 weeks, give mm-hmm. or take, is what you were working with. About how many contacts were you targeting per company, and how did you kind of settle on that?
Yeah, good question. Sort of settled on the quantity of contacts based on the volume of people, the volume of phone calls that we wanted to make per day.
Okay.
So we targeted somewhere between 40 to 60 calls per day. Mm-hmm. So we'd take these 5 companies, we'd populate about... we'd stagger these calls. So we'd make 100 calls on this 2-week cadence, every 2 days. It was somewhere about 5 contacts per department per account. That okay. was about the neighborhood. And so of course it's going to have to be customized based on, how many, what size company you're going after.
Right.
But we were going after decent sized companies. So it made sense for us to grab about 5 people from sales, 5 people from marketing, 5 from operations, and then maybe 5 executive team members, and hit them all with a different message, a different value proposition, a different customer story, whatever that hook was. I think the thing to consider when selecting your number of contacts per account is be aware and be comfortable with the idea that when you have such a high touch on a particular account, expect those people to share your message with one another.
Right.
And be comfortable defending that message and that value proposition. I knew that if I had a sales team of 50 people, I felt pretty comfortable messaging 5 of them at once. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, if I had a sales team of only 5 people, yeah, I might pick 1 or 2 that I thought were the best, I just don't want to send the message that I'm not being thoughtful. I'm just blanketing everybody, I think that helps you end up in the spam folder faster. If you don't show that you're being thoughtful and you haven't targeted a message that's really going to help your audience, that specific audience.
Yeah, and when you say defending your message, is that a situation where like are people getting annoyed or sort of what? How does that manifest? Internally.
Yeah, that's absolutely the risk. That's interesting that I don't know if I've used that phrase before in all honesty, mm-hmm. but that is a core belief. Defend the message, be able to defend the message, feel confident in the message.
And only use the message you can defend then, right?
That's right. Only use one that you can defend.
Right.
I sort of operate with the philosophy and the thinking that if I sent this message to, let's say, a C-level contact in my prospect account, and I've never spoken with them before, have I communicated my reason for reaching out in a way that makes me feel comfortable if that C-level contact were to forward my email to my own CEO?
Right.
And I want to be clear enough and articulate enough to say, when my CEO asks, hey, Dan, why did you email my friend over here? I want to be able to say, because as you can read in the email, I read an article about how executives in this customer's particular industry were leveraging our platform to accomplish XYZ specific goal. And right. I thought that based on what I saw in their 10K report, they might have a similar initiative going on, and I was wondering if they'd be interested in starting a conversation. So everything from the content, the reason for reaching out, the tonality of the message, being polite, being professionally persistent, not being arrogant, not asking for a meeting without explaining why you want one or why you think it might have value to them. Yeah, being able to defend that, that's a really good that's a really good observation, actually.
So when you are looking at, say, a mid-market or an enterprise-level company, right? We're talking about thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of employees. Where do you kind of think about starting your way in and making your way in? Like, we're working with a client right now, and they said, you know, we don't know where to start with Walmart, but we'd love to have them. And, you know, it's a question that I hear all the time, and I was wondering if you had kind of an approach to this.
Yeah, I mean that goes back to that goes back to my original emotions when I remember starting this team and we had 100% white space.
Yeah.
The whole world is what you can attack. Where do you start?
Right.
And so I think it's there. I've got a two-pronged answer for you.
Okay.
Be as thoughtful as you can about the place where about knowing your strengths and where you can add the most value.
Right.
Always try to start there. But if you're still finding that you've got too many options, and if you're selling a good product and you believe in it, you probably will find that you have too many options because you believe in all of the places that you can add value. From there, you just have to pick one. So for Walmart, I would find the smallest department in the smallest region that I could possibly find. And I would exhaust one department at a time. I would spend a lot of time building an account map. That's a topic that probably deserves its own 30-minute conversation. But getting to know the departments of your companies are critical. You're right. You cannot systematically approach Walmart as one person or one small team in a smart way. What you can do is break Walmart down into a bunch of smaller groups and then tackle those in a smart way. I would want to talk to the strawberry department for the Southwest.
Well,
within Walmart, that's probably its own team.
Sure.
There's probably 100 people in that group, and I would start with that.
That's great advice. So, Dan, I know you're sort of on to a different adventure now at Twilio, and I'm sure you're leveraging a lot of the lessons that you learned before with Box. I'm wondering if you kind of look back on the early days, say after you got out of your role as a rep and you started as a manager, what are the things you wish you would have known then that you know now that would have kind of, you know, really accelerated your growth as a manager?
I think that is a fantastic question. So much. Things I would have liked to have known as a manager in the early days. The importance of accountability and follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes two ways. I found myself, and being totally honest, I found myself in the early days suggesting a lot of ideas for things that we could all do to improve the functionality of the team or improve the performance of the team, and then I would fail to follow through on those things. I think in a team environment, there's a natural sensation that there's this accountability to the manager. But I think a topic that gets underserved is the manager's accountability to the team.
Mm-hmm.
Signing up for realistic goals, following through on those goals. That's huge. And I think that's something that, frankly, I underserved. If I could pick one more thing, which is a totally separate kind of topic, but again, I think it falls within the duties of a manager to the individuals on the team, is prioritizing your team members' time. The topic of one-on-ones is a big one for managers. I really hold that time as sacred time. And that means doing your absolute best to be there on time. I will admit that still to this day, that's a challenge. With an incredibly full calendar, it's tough to be on time. It means not moving them around last second.
Right.
It's holding them there. When it's on the calendar, it's trying to respect that. Again, not something that managers can be perfect about ever, because dynamics in the business change and priorities come up. But I think it's a general attitude that your rep's time, your team's time is incredibly valuable, needs to be treated as such, needs to be held as sacred when you have one-on-one time. And managers need to be accountable to their team. They need to show up, they need to be there, they need to demonstrate the work ethic that that they expect to see.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to hold people accountable if you're not accountable to yourself, obviously. And certainly it's hard to get people to buy into your vision if you're not there for them as well. So totally agree with that. And we're very bullish on one-on-ones. And kind of our core belief is that grooming great salespeople works like creating a professional athlete, right? Mm-hmm. You don't become the best home run hitter or pitcher in baseball by reading books. You have to do it. You have to get coached. You have to observe yourself. You have to take in those observations and improve along the way. So certainly your showing up, I'm sure, is helping a lot of people on your team.
Well, thank you. And I love that perspective. I'll share that I myself have a coach. In recent years, I've enlisted an external coach because I believe exactly what you just said. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a professional athlete or a professional in the workplace, we can all benefit from coaching. Really good coaches are just helping you see the things that you know you can do better yourself, and then getting you to think about how you would improve that. I talk a lot on my team about building a culture of continuous improvement. Working as a rep, or really working in any job, you never arrive, you never finish, you never are there. Being there, listening, and in our world, I think customer calls are the best example of being on the job. That's performing. That's the pinnacle skill set in this world. It's how do you interface with your customers? Do you listen to them? Do you ask smart, intelligent questions? Were you prepared for that interaction? So I love listening to those calls, and hopefully my team has come to expect a fairly consistent form of feedback after those calls. I like a process. It's really basic. It's not rocket science, but it's great. I pick one thing to suggest that they start doing,
mm-hmm.
one thing to suggest that they stop doing, and I want to list out all of the things that I heard that I want them to continue to do.
Right. Yeah, that's great.
No matter what stage you're at, there's always something to start, there's always something to stop, and there's always a bunch of things to continue because you're in this position, you're already being successful.
Yeah, I like that model because it also keeps it simple. They're not, thinking of the, 1,000 things I need to start doing, because it really happens one at a time.
For anybody that's had golf lessons, they can empathize with that. I took a golf lesson once. My coach told me 15 things to fix, and I couldn't do a single one of them. So you're right. It's incremental. It's just one thing at a time. That's all you can really think about.
Right. And then that compound interest effect as you start to layer those on top of each other really pays
off. That's
how
you build a career. Yeah.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for being here. It's been really, really informative, and I'm sure everybody listening to this has gotten a ton out of you being here and you being so open and candid about your experience. If people wanted to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do that?
LinkedIn. For sure. So I'm Dan Burrell. I work at an incredible company called Twilio. This is the best job I've ever had. I've been here for a year and a half. I'm excited to be here for years to come. Please find me on LinkedIn. I may have a Twitter handle floating out there somewhere. Good luck tracking it down. I'm not using it as much as I should anymore. But please find me on LinkedIn. I'd love to hear from you.
Cool. And I'll put that in the show notes. So Dan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for having me, Lisa. This was great.